From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Pittsburgh this past September. A new report had surfaced focusing on racial and gender disparities in the city. As noted by Jennifer Vay of Brookings, the reports were not kind to Pittsburgh. Here's an example of one of the headlines, quote, "Pittsburgh, a most livable city, but not for black women," end quote. Vay writes that the story of Pittsburgh is the story of so many American cities. A downtown boom might look promising. There's new investment, hot neighborhoods. But when the prosperity is concentrated in one place, other city neighborhoods feel forgotten and excluded from success. Here's more from Vay's piece, quote, "Throughout the country, the challenges wrought by our widening geographic inequities, characterized by stark income, wealth, and race-based disparities across neighborhoods, cities, and regions, are becoming even more apparent, thrusting place to the forefront of many economic policy conversations," end quote. Vay is coming to Rochester to discuss a concept known as transformative placemaking, and she's well qualified to do that. In November of 2018, Brookings established a Center for Transformative Placemaking. Vay will be a guest of the Community Design Center as they roll out their 2020 Reshaping Rochester series. But first, Jennifer Vay is our guest here on Connection, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Transformative Placemaking at the Brookings Institution. Welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Very good. And with us in studio, Maria Fergiuelli is the Executive Director of the Community Design Center Rochester. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Andre Primus is with us, a planner with Highland Planning LLC. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Maria, briefly here, this is the rollout of the 2020 calendar here, and the women are taking over. Women heavily featured in the speaking series here. What's the is there a theme for 2020 for Reshaping Rochester?
Well, our theme this year is building community through placemaking. Placemaking had a shout out in the comp plan that Rochester has adopted, and we really felt that it was a great opportunity to bring people from all over the country to share information of how placemaking is being done and done well. The women's theme came from wanting to commemorate Susan B. Anthony's 200th birthday. This is a very important year for women, the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and the fact that Rochester has a unique place in the history of the women's suffrage. So we really wanted to commemorate that by inviting women from all over the country to speak.
All right, the event next Wednesday, that's January 29th at 6 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium. Anything listeners need to know about that?
Well, yes, new this year is we've moved the lecture series up by an hour, so the new time is 6 p.m. We've created a bridge, which is a meet and greet between 4:30 and 5:45, directly across the street from Gleason Works at the 40 and 8 Club, open to the public, so please stop by. We'd love to see you.
All right, Andre, tell us a little bit about your work with Highland Planning, what you're doing these days as a planner.
Yeah, so Highland Planning is a local firm that focuses on community engagement. So we work in lots of different projects. It might be a housing project, a transportation project. We worked with RTS on their new redesign, and we focus on going to the community and running meetings, going door-to-door, talking to people, doing online surveys, and making sure that the people who are going to be affected by decisions are able to give their input to those decisions.
And Andre will have a lot to say about transformative placemaking here in Rochester. Let me ask Jennifer, you know, if you wanted to kind of define it, because you've written a lot about transformative placemaking, how it's different essentially from creative placemaking or tactical placemaking. So why don't you explain what it is for our listeners?
Sure. Well, when we talk about transformative placemaking, we are talking about something that sort of sets traditional notions of placemaking apart in a couple of ways. It's really about, one, a broader scope. So when we talk about transformative placemaking, we're talking about places that, about really trying to create destinations for work and for commerce and for recreation and residential life that really generate economic value for a broader city and region. So this is really about prioritizing place-based investments that support creativity and entrepreneurship, sociability, community identity, and really robust civic structures, not just in kind of your already high amenity or very highly resourced areas, but those that have really long been overlooked. So when because we have this more expansive scope, that really demands then that we focus on a larger geographic scale that is larger than just a block or a public space. It really centers on specific sub-areas of cities or regions where economic and infrastructure and other kind of assets cluster and connect, but where the reach and the impact of those assets might be limited by varying place-based kind of challenges.
So let me just kind of hit an important point here, and I touched on this in the intro, because Jennifer, I don't know how much time you've had to spend in Rochester in recent years, but you know, we'll get into it later this hour. We'll talk about the Comp Plan 2034 that Maria referenced. But generally speaking, whether it's Pittsburgh, whether it's Rochester, when people talk about how a city is doing, I think who is doing the talking sort of defines what they actually mean by that. And I think too many of us, probably me included, people in the media, people in the business community, frankly, people in the sectors of power, they're talking about sort of downtown or clusters of development. Is that a common theme that you're seeing throughout the country, that, you know, the downtown areas may be doing well, but there are outlying neighborhoods and there's neighborhoods across the city that may not be doing well, and you've got big disparities?
Yeah, that's, I think that's absolutely true. And look, for a long time, we had many of our urban areas across the country that really weren't doing so well. And they had seen, you know, over a number of decades with our rampant suburbanization around the country, they had seen population loss, job loss, and overall decline in urban areas. So as that started to shift over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, as we were seeing more people moving back to urban areas, more jobs moving back to urban areas, we were seeing a lot of that activity happening in certain parts of town, right? In exactly the places you mentioned, in your downtown areas or maybe around waterfront areas or other areas that maybe already had a certain amount of, you know, assets or amenities. So, you know, this has had, no doubt, a lot of really positive impacts, particularly for places that just hadn't seen a lot of that growth for a long, long time. The problem is that it's still leaving a lot of places out of the mix, places that may themselves have a lot of assets, but they're just continuing to be undervalued or overlooked by the marketplace and often by the public sector as well.
Andre, how do you see right now sort of that conversation about downtown vis-a-vis Rochester neighborhoods and disparities?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that the city is trying to do is to try to expand some of that success outwards. You know, one of the first things that they did was remove the inner loop on the east side, mm-hmm. And try to connect, you know, the already relatively well-performing neighborhood of the East End with downtown and try to get some synergy between that. But the city is now looking at removing the northern part of the inner loop, and, you know, that is a very different situation because that northern neighborhoods are much poorer, a higher percentage of minorities than the East End. And so it's going to be really interesting to see as they move forward with that, how are they able to connect some of that success from downtown to those other neighborhoods? And, you know, hopefully there's examples like, you know, what Jennifer is working on that'll allow us to use some of that material to make that successful in Rochester.
Yeah, I think a lot of us assume that the rest of the inner loop is going to get filled eventually, right? I mean, the eastern third's now been filled, and they're working on development there. Your assumption the same for you?
Well, I know that the city is doing a study on whether they should fill the northern section. I assume that the study is going to say yes, because I think that there's a lot of good reasons to do it. I don't know about the rest of it, but, you know, that's most important to me because I grew up in Markview Heights. I live in Beechwood. That's, you know, that's sort of my hood. So I'm interested in the change that could make in my neighborhood.
Okay. And I'll ask Jennifer about this in a second here. But when you think about different levels of sort of success, growth, economic opportunity across city neighborhoods, I think it's one thing to hear this discussion and hear people say, well, you can't just concentrate development downtown. You got to spread it out. But you have to have people who want to spread out and places to do that. And I'm not saying it's impossible at all, but it's also not as easy as just saying, we'll do it. I mean, how do you view sort of the challenge, probably starting with the will and the want to, but how do you see that, you know, sort of being prioritized?
Well, I mean, one of the things in Rochester 2034 is they focus on starting from some of the areas that are doing well and trying to grow those and expand those out rather than doing piecemeal sort of investment where you drop a little money here, drop a little money there, to, you know, have a sort of strategy where you're actually being able to expand success outwards. The real issue that we find, you know, in my work when we're going around and talking to people is do people trust that that is going to be good for their neighborhood? Because a lot of people fear that it's going to create gentrification or that they're going to get driven out. they want investment in their neighborhood, but they want investment that's going to benefit them and not displace them. And there's we're still trying to figure out in Rochester how to have that conversation in a way that everyone feels confident that it's going to be successful.
Okay, Maria, you want to add to that before I turn to Jennifer?
Yes, I think that's where the importance of community engagement comes in, that it gives us the opportunity to have a vehicle for communication, one, in being able to have people in the communities express their wants and needs and hopes and dreams for their neighborhoods, but also as a way to inform community members about the different processes and the limitations of the development process itself, the process, the timeline, the budgets, the various requirements. So education is a big part of what we do at the Community Design Center. I really just want to emphasize that community engagement, it really acts as a two-way street to build that community trust.
Okay. Well, Jennifer, you know, we're going to get a little bit more specific in a moment about some of the tenets of transformative placemaking, including social environment. But before we even do that, can you add to what Andre was talking about in terms of the various approaches or ideas about how to take success from a certain sector and either grow it maybe from where it exists already versus maybe a piecemeal approach, knowing that every city is going to have a different sort of structure and different kind of layout of neighborhoods, but what do you think sort of is a worthwhile approach to finding something that works?
Sure. Well, for one thing, I think, you know, all cities or regions really need to understand the differential, you know, assets and challenges of their communities, right? Not all communities are the same. They have, you know, different opportunity structures that are there. And I think first really understanding that is a first step in trying to make the kind of decisions. And sometimes that means, you know, having priorities in terms of not just where investment is going to happen, but where different types of investment is going to happen. Just, you know, spreading dollars too thinly across the landscape, I think we've seen, isn't necessarily always the most effective strategy, particularly if those dollars really aren't necessarily being targeted at the right time, the right kinds of activities or efforts at the right time. And so it really starts with understanding your communities and understanding the differential assets and attributes and challenges that they're experiencing, and then really strategizing from there on, all right, how do we then build on the opportunities where they exist and try to address some of the barriers to reaching those opportunities.
Any cities stand out immediately as going, boy, they're really doing this right. Look what they're doing. Look at all the neighborhood growth, not just in a downtown sector or not just concentrated.
Look, you know, and we get asked this question a lot, and it's sort of in many ways a hard question to answer because, you know, these are really sticky, very challenging issues. And I think, you know, in some ways, most cities are doing something along these lines, or at least they're far more cognizant of the need to be expanding beyond their downtowns or their waterfronts or some of their successful areas. And they may be doing it in more in specific, you know, targeted strategies. But it's hard to say, you know, point to one particular city and say, yep, they're doing it all right. You know, they've got the master plan that's being implemented. Rather, I think what you're seeing is some of it's more incremental. And a lot of it's happening from the bottom up too, where, you know, there are places that are gaining traction in their city economy, and it's being driven in part from really strong civic engagement at the neighborhood level that's working to lift places up.
So you write that a priority of transformative placemaking is fostering a cohesive social environment that is reflective, and I love this part, of community history and identity. So how do we do that, especially for areas where underrepped groups don't feel that their voices are heard?
Sure, and I think we do this in a number of ways, and I just say that this point about the social cohesion is really part of our kind of broader framework for transformative placemaking that includes nurturing an economic ecosystem that's regionally connected and inclusive, supporting a built environment that's accessible and flexible and advances health and resiliency, and also about the civic structures. So it's really this four kind of pronged approach. But to your question about the social environment, you know, this really grows from a place that, you know, for so many communities where they have seen investment, and this kind of gets to what Andre was saying, you know, it hasn't necessarily benefited the people who were there. It's, you know, it's been, it's places have seen that investment with a goal, say, of, you know, attracting talent. That's certainly a big mantra for a lot of places, and not wholly misplaced. But what that has tended to do then is often maybe ignore the needs of the population that's there, and it ignore the identity of those places. And so it's really important, as places are developing, to maintain that kind of identity and investing, you know, in the historic assets and in the cultural assets that are already there. And that can take place in a number of different ways. I mean, first of all, you have to understand what those, and hearing from the community of what that identity is and what its history is. And does that mean reinvigorating, structures that one time were big music venues in the area, for example? Does it mean having the kind of programming in public spaces that really is something that the existing community is interested in and wants to participate in, as opposed to just, you know, attracting folks from outside? But it's really, you know, just a crucial part of this whole framework to be cognizant of creating that kind of social environment.
Andre, what do you make of how you create sort of this idea of social cohesion, community history and identity included in that process?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, again, in our work, when we're doing public engagement, we kind of talk about often like wide engagement and focused engagement. And some projects, you just want wide engagement. You want to talk to everybody in the city. You want to send out a survey and hope, you know, a whole bunch of people answer it. But with things like this, we find that going into a community and, you know, talking to people in person, writing down their stories, writing down their experiences, asking them, you know, questions about how they felt about different things that happened in the history of their community and the things that are looking forward, you know, that helps us to discover, you know, what those stories are. Now, you know, our work, we don't get into the implementation a lot. We make plans. You know, we're planners. So we make plans and we pass them on to, you know, urban designers and transportation planners and things like that. And they, you know, make a plan. But to be able to then take the understanding of what that story is and make it into something that's real in the community is a whole other step that, you know, that's one of the things that I'm hoping that we're going to start seeing out of 2034, now that it's adopted and everything. Now we have to actually do it. You know, we can't let it sit on a shelf. And so to be able to take these plans that we spent the time to listen to people and understand their stories and make them into something real is kind of the next step. That's a transformative step. That's what we need to get at.
Yeah, I recently on social media, I saw my much cooler colleague Veronica Volk posted I think it was like a hipster development bingo. And it was all the things that American cities are trying to cater to the hipsters for. You know, and we're sort of blown up all the any building that isn't currently used, so we can put in things like craft beer, hip coffee shops, taquerias. Like, it's all good. I like that stuff, and mm-hmm. I actually don't have a problem with it. But the point was sort of like the vanilla same, as opposed to what's unique about a place. I would hope that you can do both, but I'm also hopeful that there is more of an interest in story and community narrative and mm-hmm. shared history. I mean, is that just sort of my perspective because I host the show and we talk about it all the time? Or do you think in the work you're doing, are people more interested in that?
Yeah, they are. And I think that, you know, I think one of the troubles with Rochester general is we have such a strong history, in the 1800s, 1900s, you know, with Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass and stuff like that, that we think of that as our story. But I think that there are a lot of smaller stories in the neighborhoods, you know, that have to deal with how they've dealt with adversity or, the communities that came up around, certain groups of people, you know, and we aren't always telling those stories. We kind of default to the stories that everyone knows, and, oh yeah, everyone knows Susan B. Anthony, that's great.
I actually wish more people knew those stories.
I guess. I mean, I feel like the people I interact with know those
stories.
I know,
too. I hear you.
But I feel like there are smaller stories that, you know, like, even a medium-sized story, not a small story, but, you know, the Clarissa Street reunion. Like,
oh yeah.
Like, to be able to talk about those stories, yeah. Why is that the only... There were a lot more black neighborhoods that were destroyed than just Clarissa Street. But that's the only one that still has a reunion every year where they actually tell those stories. And so to be able to surface more of that would be great.
Mm. Maria, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
Yes, we've always been advocates for being able to tell those stories as a way to create those authentic spaces in the neighborhood. It grounds the history. It calls out unique characteristics of the neighborhood. I've had the great pleasure of touring our speakers. Every time we have a speaker visit, I take them through the city, and I find myself describing every neighborhood that we drive through. And I see that all these neighborhoods throughout the city have these unique stories, have these beginnings of these really interesting identities that differentiate one from the other. And we don't pay enough attention to that, and I think we should.
Hmm. We're talking about transformative placemaking and possible impact on communities like Rochester. With our guest, you just heard Maria Fergiuelli, who's the executive director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Andre Primus is with us in studio. He's a planner with Highland Planning. And on the line with us, in a difference, where are you, Jennifer Vey? Where are you coming to us from?
I am coming from you to you from Washington, D.C.
I figured Washington, but all the smarter people in this building do all the work, and I just come in here and have to talk to you. So Jennifer is joining us from Washington. She's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Transformative Placemaking at the Brookings Institution, and she'll be in Rochester next week as a guest of the Community Design Center for their annual Reshaping Rochester series. The event is next Wednesday, 6 p.m., an earlier start than usual, 6 p.m., that's the noob start time at Gleason Works Auditorium. If you want to attend, they'd love to see you there, and more information at the Community Design Center's website about that. So as we talk about sort of transformative placemaking, in our second half hour, we will talk a little bit about Plan 2034 and how our guests in studio see that and how Jennifer sees long-term planning, because I guess I want to ask you, Jennifer, how successful you see long-term planning, because one of the things that's tough is you see different changes in mayoral administrations and city council and leadership and the business community. So when there is a plan, I mean, I think Bill Johnson, who was a former Rochester mayor, they had a 20, maybe 19, or there was some sort of a plan that was 20 years out, and it's all well-intended. I'm sure everyone who makes these things knows that's not exactly what's going to happen. There's just too many dynamic factors. But how worthwhile is that long-term outlook, knowing that the leadership will change, Jennifer?
Sure. Well, I think every place has to have a vision for where it wants to go.
Okay.
Clearly. But it's really important that that vision is flexible because, you know, things change. The market changes. There's population and demographic shifts. And so the plan, I think any plan has to be written with that in mind and have that kind of flexibility almost built into it. And that's why I think it's important for plans to sort of be more outcome oriented, to really look forward and saying, what do we really want to see in our community? What do we want to see in our region writ large? What does that mean for the communities within our region? And that's really in many ways, when we talk about transformative placemaking at this place level, at the hyperlocal level, that's what we're trying to create, is to really outline a framework for an outcome-oriented framework that says, here's where you want to go. And there may be many different ways to get there, many pathways that are going to be really specific to particular, you know, cities and regions, to particular places within them. And within that, it then built into that is that ability to be adaptable over time. And I think that's true for any kind of long-term planning effort.
Well, Rochester is, I don't know if Rust Belt is viewed sort of as a pejorative, and I'm always careful about that, but I think people generally know what we're talking about when we talk about cities sort of in that region across the Midwest. I grew up in Cleveland. I mean, you see a lot of sort of similar struggling factors, whether it's smaller towns, larger towns, the Youngstown, the Akrons, the Clevelands, Detroits, Rochester, so many others. Is there any similar thread that you've seen, Jennifer, that helps cities in that category, whether it's moving into new sort of forms of economies or similar structures, dealing with infrastructures that change? Is there any similar thread that Rochester can sort of glean?
Sure. And first of all, you know, you're absolutely right. And work by several of my colleagues, you know, here at Brookings, Mark Muro and others, have really, really documented what you're talking about, that when you look across the country, what we're seeing is that the digital economy is rewarding larger global centers that are continuing to attract innovative companies and highly educated workers, while many older industrial cities and regions like Rochester, many heartland communities, and particularly even your small and mid-sized rural towns are kind of struggling to keep place. So this is some pace. This really is something that, that unites these places in many ways. But what you also see is these places have a tremendous number of assets. One, they've got, you know, they've got history. They've got a history of industry. Certainly you see that in a place like Rochester that can be built on. You know, whatever their competitive advantage was in the past, oftentimes that's something that can be built on for the future. They have, you know, a lot of universities are located in these areas, particularly, you know, a lot of your downtown universities. You see this again in a place like Rochester. Often they were built on waterways. They have strong transportation infrastructure. So there's a lot to work with in these places. And it's, you know, really trying to seize on that. And this is where we think this idea of place is so important, that, you know, part of what places really need to do is be cognizant of the history of their place, of those assets, and really being, you know, making those kind of transformative investments in their places to generate, you know, wide social and economic benefits, to really create that vibrancy that increasingly, you know, businesses and people want in their communities.
Brookings has written a lot about Detroit's resurgence. Let me quote from Brookings on this. Detroit emerged from the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history to experience economic resurgence. That was due in part to collaboration among philanthropy, business, and government. Detroit is benefiting from private and public sector investments downtown and across its neighborhoods. Today, there are revived neighborhoods, new businesses, a downtown innovation district, the M1 rail transit corridor, and a spirit of creativity and entrepreneurialism, end quote. Detroit, yeah, Jennifer, is obviously a larger city than Rochester. And here's what I think makes lay sort of observers like me nervous. When we watched the whole Amazon bidding war across the country, it wasn't all that interesting to me because it felt like, wow, what a shock. They picked Washington and New York. I thought they were definitely going to pick a Raleigh or a Tulsa. I mean, nobody really thought that. I mean, and what we're seeing is further and further concentration in a smaller and smaller amount of geographic spaces. If Detroit is an example of at least some positive lessons of resurgence, is Detroit still in too large a city category for Rochester to learn from, or is that model still transferable even though you get smaller in city size?
Sure, I think certainly many of the things that, that you mentioned with Detroit are transferable to other places. One, you know, that engagement by the philanthropic sector, by the civic sector, by local government, right? And that's, you know, that's applicable anywhere, that you really need to have, you know, have these different leaders in the economy come together to kind of set that vision for place and really making the kind of investments, whether that's in transportation like Detroit did, in public spaces, in, you know, their economy. So yeah, I mean, these are important for the biggest places down to the smaller places. There's some basic, you know, principles. And that's why even when we talk about transformative placemaking, it's broadly applicable to big places as well as your rural places.
Let me ask our guests in studio. Andre, any concerns that as we see more and more economic concentration, that the chances for cities like Rochester to have sort of a dynamic resurgence across sectors gets harder, you know, when more and more economic activity is concentrated in fewer hands and it's going to bigger and bigger cities? Or do you have confidence that Rochester is sort of on a track that you'd like to see?
Well, I mean, the concentration of economic power in any sense is an issue. You know, concentration of economic power at the top of the sort of income range with the 1% idea, or the concentration in a few very large cities, you know, in any sense, that's going to be an issue. And I think that that's something that as a country and we're going to have to start wrestling with. But I, you know, to get back to what Jennifer was saying about resources, you know, Rochester has not just the resources that she mentioned, but also we have agricultural resources. You know, we sit on next to some of the largest source of fresh water in the world. We, you know, we sit on very, very rich agricultural soil. You know, we are in an area where we can actually go back to some of the things that some of the reasons that the city was founded. You know, like she mentioned, the river. And I think that, you know, in the age of climate change, in the age of increasing mobility and migration of people around the world, I think that those things are actually going to become assets that are really important. And, you know, the city has recently done a climate change resilience plan, and one of the things that we assessed as a risk and or a benefit is we may have lots of climate refugees coming into this area mm-hmm. because, you know, New York City's right next to the water and Los Angeles is running out of water, but Rochester's right next to all the fresh water, you know. So there are different factors that I think are going to be more and more important as we go forward in the next century.
I mean, people far smarter than me have written really interesting stuff about what's happening in the American West when it comes to water usage and water availability. Everything is commodified these days, and you're right. We're sitting next to this massive water source, which is only going to become more valuable. Not to be cynical about it, but that's just the truth. And it's interesting. I heard somebody recently, Maria, say, "I'm from Minnesota. It's nice to come to a place that has mild winters." They moved to Rochester. Yeah, so
never hear that.
I know. But interestingly enough, the first two cities I saw the New York Times cite as being as actually advertising themselves as future good places during the era of climate change, as Andre mentions, are Buffalo, New York, and Duluth, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So when you think about northern cities like that, I guess you were nodding, you know, vigorously when he talked about the assets we have beyond just being a river city or having the industrial sort of framework from past job sectors.
Well, we don't often celebrate what Rochester really has. I went to college in New York City. My friends in New York City never even imagined going to upstate New York because they had it all in Manhattan. And yet when they come to visit, they are blown away by the amazing history, culture, richness in manufacturing, even just the geographic assets that we have. So I think one of the best things that Rochester has going for it is it is a compact and could be a very walkable urban center. And young people are really looking at placemaking as a way that they choose where to live. So we have the opportunity to create this really unique city that can feature placemaking as one of the tools that can really create a place that people want to be in. And we haven't fully explored that yet, but it's never too late.
Well, as we go to break, I just want to kind of refer back to, you know, Andre was making, I think, such an important point. We think about Susan B. We think about Frederick Douglass. He is hearing people and a desire to kind of even go more granular, the history of communities and sort of even micro communities, neighborhoods. He's referencing revivals and all these different interesting things that are already happening. I'm thinking of Trevor Noah, who said, "I didn't even know that Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony were from Rochester until he was up at RIT speaking." And we're going, wow. So I think we can do both while still maintaining that great history that we have here. I just find such value. And even for me, someone who's sort of a history geek, I'm just going to fess up to something here. When my son started playing Pokemon Go, the Pokestops are often historical sites. We're walking around the city going, "Whoa, I had no idea this plaque was here. I'm going to read this. Oh, look at I didn't know this." So thank you, Pokemon Go, and all my Pokemon Go stands out there. It's amazing the history around us. The question is, what are we doing to cultivate it and use it to our advantage? And that's part of the conversation here. Andre Primus, a planner with Highland Planning, Maria Fergiuelli, Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester, and Jennifer Vey is with us, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Transformative Placemaking at the Brookings Institution. She'll be in Rochester next Wednesday night, and you can hear her presentation about transformative placemaking as part of the Reshaping Rochester series. That's next Wednesday, January 29th, 6 p.m., at the Gleason Works Auditorium. On the other side of this break, we'll talk a little bit more about Plan 2034 and what our guests think of that. Coming up in our second hour on WXXI, you'll hear live coverage of the impeachment proceedings and the trial in the Senate. And on WRUR, a previously recorded conversation about compassion fatigue. What to do whether you're a police officer, a teacher, a parent, someone struggling with too much emotional overload. We'll talk about compassion fatigue next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Some interesting listener feedback. Let me start with Elizabeth in Fairport on the phone. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi. Hi, Maria.
Hi there.
It's Beth. I've worked in the, I had worked in the water conservation area since I was in in college and graduate school. And the one thing that, and I ended up working for the city of New York and their water, land protection and water protection agencies. And one of the things that all of the experts in water conservation forever have said is that the Northeast is going to be the place where the pressure comes, because there's going to be scarcity. There already is scarcity. I mean, even 30, 35 years ago, there was this scarcity, and they were foreseeing our Northeast area being a place where there was going to be a lot of pressure. So I think that that's one thing that people have to take into consideration when we talk about planning for our area, is that there will be a growth. It's just, there's no question about it. It's not just our area, it's the entire Northeast area, Great Lakes. So, you know, a lot of people are moving south, but there's still a lot of people are going to be coming to our area because we have the water.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
No, thank you very much, Beth. And you know, I think, though, as a planner, this is where it's got to be hard, because we are still a region that's losing population for the moment. Mm-hmm. Beth is saying, you know, unless something really quite amazing happens with climate change, almost inevitably, we will eventually see an increase in population. How do you plan for that, Andre Primus?
Yeah, that's a big question you just asked. I mean, the way you do to plan for that is exactly what Maria said. You got to be flexible. And actually, maybe Jennifer said that, but you got to be flexible with your plans. You got to make sure that your plans have an end goal, but they don't. You're able to take different paths there. And I think that you know, Rochester 2034. One of the things that it explicitly says is that it's going to be planning for growth. That it's not going to assume that we're always going to be declining, but that we are going to make sure that we have the framework, the legal framework, the zoning framework, the infrastructure that we need to grow when that happens.
Jennifer, you want to add to that?
Sure. No, that's absolutely true. You again, you need that flexibility. And Rochester, look, the region is growing, but very slowly. The city has actually lost some population, but that absolutely may shift in the future. And I think planning for that is really important, particularly because it once was a bigger city. And when you have a city that's lost population, that means you've got land, you've got vacancy of buildings and other challenges that brings. So but on the flip side, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to say, how do we repurpose some of our what may now feel like excess for the future? And that can mean, you know, certainly repopulating and reinvesting in the building and the built environment, the physical fabric. But it also means thinking about the natural environment as well, even in the urban context, so that when we think about, you know, environmental issues and our long-term sustainability, you're thinking about how land can be used as, you know, as urban wetlands, as for stormwater management, and to help mitigate against some of the environmental challenges that no doubt we're going to continue to see.
Yeah, there's so many sort of sub-threads to this conversation that should be its own conversation as we talk about sort of planning for climate refugees, a changing future, and we'll certainly do that as time goes on here. I want to return to something that Maria said during a brief break, which is the notion that more people are thinking about place when they move, sometimes as they age, what can be accessed. And tell me briefly about the point you're making, and then I want to read from a piece from City Observatory. Go ahead.
Yes, my college roommate's family is from Westport, Connecticut, and as they've gotten older, they're feeling very isolated. They live in a big house. There's, as much as we feel that they're connected to a big urban center like New York City, that's not their everyday experience. And so they're looking for a place where they can live, where they can have walkability, and where they can maintain a certain quality of life. And I've advocated for Rochester because we have that. We have that opportunity to have a very reasonable cost of living, and we have the proximity to be able to create great walkable environments.
Well, I think Jennifer was one of the many who tweeted and linked to the City Observatory piece by Joe Courtwright, "Walkable places are growing in value almost everywhere." And let me read from Joe's piece. Quote, "Over the past decade across the nation, the most walkable homes have appreciated the most. In two-thirds of large metro areas, walkable neighborhoods have higher home values than car-dependent ones. Walkable neighborhoods appreciated faster than car-dependent ones in 44 of 51 large metro areas in the past 7 years. So first, why don't you, Jennifer, tell me what you make of that trend?
Sure. And research by Chris Leinberger and Tracy Lowe has found this these same trends that, yeah, it's exactly what Maria was saying. There is higher demand for places that are walkable, that are dynamic, that are vibrant, that are amenity rich. And we focus a lot on, you know, the millennials, attracting the millennials, you know, because they want those sorts of environments. But to Maria's point, this is really about a much broader group of the population. One, it's about existing residents who often want the same thing. It's just maybe they haven't gotten it because they haven't seen the investments in walkability and in creating that kind of physical fabric and in investing in the assets and amenities that I think at some level everybody demands. But there are also, you know, new opportunities to even bring people who may not have that now, may live in the suburbs, older populations that may be looking for those kind of environments, and urban areas, you know, urban areas provide them. And particularly for older populations, you know, one, it's about the walkability, it's about transit accessibility, and it's, you know, for it's about, you know, proximity to universities that often have classes and other things that are available to older adults. It's about being close to, you know, cultural institutions, and even medical care that's often located in urban areas. So there's a lot of opportunities as you know, we're seeing this kind of reprioritization of place for places that have that fabric. They just need to really invest in it, like I think Rochester is through this new plan.
Okay, so, you know, one of the terms we're kind of tossing around with this story is appreciation in home values, which in a moment I want to return to something Andre mentioned earlier, which is how you grapple with that, which is not a bad thing necessarily, but it can lead to gentrification. So back to that in just a moment. But let me read a comment from Dan on Twitter, who has a different take on this. He says, young people are always complaining that they can't afford anything. Young people need to stop moving to trendy city neighborhoods and stretch their dollars in the suburbs where they can get a lot more house and land for their money. That's from Dan on Twitter. Okay, Jennifer, you want to respond to that?
Oh, well, that's certainly contextual to the individual market. I mean, it's certainly true that we do have regions in the country that are really have really difficult affordability, you know, issues. Certainly on the coast, some of the major cities, the Bay Area, New York City, Washington, Boston. But that's less the case in a lot of parts of the country. And that dynamic really, it's so, you know, dependent on the local market. So one, it may not even be true that in an area like Rochester that younger people or anybody can't necessarily afford to live in urban areas. And two, I think there's trade-offs there. People also may be willing to spend a little bit more money to live in an area where, for example, they may not need a car because they can walk places or take public transportation. And I think you can't just look at housing and size when, you know, people may prefer to live in a smaller place where they have access to restaurants and cultural activities and other types of amenities right at their fingertips, and they don't necessarily need to own a car to be able to access them. That also brings down their cost. And so when we talk about cost, we really need to be looking at both housing but also transportation, as well as all the other things that factor into people's decisions on where they want to live or now or in the future.
Maria, what would you say to Dan?
Well, my parents were the typical drive to you qualify. So when I was in middle school, they built a new house in Macedon. And that was kind of the edge of the suburbs at that time. They never took into consideration the fact that they would need to buy a new car every 2 years because they had to commute back and forth from Kodak. Now they couldn't commute together, so they had to commute separately. So multiply that expense. Infrastructure costs were huge. They never considered the telephone bill, the RG&E and electric bill. So we don't often consider all of the financial impacts of living in a less dense area. And of course, we at the Community Design Center really promote about creating environments where anybody can find a place to fit in. So certainly there will be people who would prefer to live in the suburbs. But we also are finding that the urban environment that most people crave doesn't currently exist in our area. And that's why we're seeing so much attention being paid to the urban landscape.
Well, Andre, you mentioned gentrification earlier this hour. And as we see home values go up in more walkable places, and as we see these kind of trends, I want to ask you for maybe what you would say to the kind of comment that I've heard many times over the years hosting this program as we talk gentrification. Inevitably, someone will write or call and say a flavor of the following. You've got some struggling city neighborhoods. You want to see investment and emphasis. Then you get it. Values go up and people complain about gentrification. We're damned if we do, damned if we don't. What do you say to that, first of all, Andre?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's not always the story, because you see differences in different neighborhoods. There's gentrification, you know, has happened all around the country, but we're seeing some places like, you know, the neighborhood I'm living in right now, Beechwood, where we're seeing a sort of very gentle growth that's very cognizant of the people who are already living there, and there's still work to be done there to increase home ownership among the people who live there now, who are renters, things like that, and to create development without displacement. But we're starting that work. You know, the City Roots Community Land Trust is working to create permanent affordability in that neighborhood. There's lots of different aspects that can actually create growth without that gentrification. And I think that, you know, the other factor here is that Rochester's housing issues are a little different than most other places' housing issues, just because our incomes are so low. You know, if you look at any of our housing, you would think, oh, compared to the rest of the country, that's very affordable. But if you look at any of our, you know, incomes, we have such a high poverty level that it's not affordable to them. And so we actually need to work on both ends, where if we were able to raise the incomes of some of these people living in these neighborhoods and give them opportunities to be first-time home buyers, then we'd be able to put investment in that neighborhood without doing any displacement at all. So,
yeah, Jennifer, can you add to that question on that push-pull of growth and gentrification?
Sure. And first of all, I think it depends on what we're really talking about when we use the term gentrification.
Sure.
Because people use the term to mean many mm-hmm. different things. And, you know, at one end, it's actually about displacement, right? Are people, you know, it's so much investment happening in a place that it becomes unaffordable for existing residents and they have to move somewhere else. That actually is not usually the case. If you look across the country, that's certainly happening in some neighborhoods and in some markets, actually far more prevalent. And Joe Courtwright, who you were talking about earlier, has shown this through some of his research, as have others, that in fact, across the country, the growth in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty is far more of a challenge and is far more widespread than displacement. Having said that, gentrification also, I think, for many means sort of cultural gentrification, too, where you see a lot of newcomers coming into the neighborhood and coming back to our conversation about community identity and ownership. And often it changes the neighborhood in a way that people say, this isn't my place anymore, mm-hmm. right? You know, I might have grown up here and I've been living here for a long time, and yet I'm seeing such rapid change that I don't even recognize it anymore. And I think this is where, when we talk about issues of gentrification, yes, ensuring long-term affordability is certainly key, but it's also important to be trying to maintain that sort of cultural identity. And that doesn't mean that places stay static. They're not going to stay static. People are going to come and they're going to go, and that's actually a good thing. But we do need to be cognizant of how do you make sure that as places grow, that it's really addressing the needs and the desires of existing residents, not just the newcomers who are moving to the neighborhood.
All right, Maria Fergiuelli, remind us what's happening next Wednesday.
All right. Next Wednesday is the kickoff of our Reshaping Rochester 2020 lecture series. We're so thrilled to have Jen Vey be our first presenter, 6 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium. And please join us for a meet and greet beforehand between 4:30 and 5:45.
And the Community Design Center of Rochester is online. You can find their full schedule for the Reshaping Rochester series 2020 there. And we look forward to future conversations. Thanks for helping, and thanks for being here, and we'll see you next Wednesday. Thank you.
Andre
Primus is a planner with Highland Palette. Is that you, Jennifer? Do you want to jump in?
Oh, yes.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, no,
go ahead.
I was just going to thank you, but please, go ahead. We got a little time. Go ahead.
No. I was actually just going to say how much I'm looking forward to coming to Rochester next week. It's been a few years since I've been there, so I'm looking forward to it.
I know they're looking forward to having you. Jennifer is a senior fellow and director of the Center for Transformative Placemaking at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for taking the time, Jennifer.
Sure. Happy to be here.
And Andre Primus, a planner with Highland Planning. Always good. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Reminder for our listeners, right here on WXXI, you can hear live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial coming up right here at 1 o'clock. If you want to hear Connections, we've got a previously recorded edition and a really good conversation about a problem known as compassion fatigue. Whether you're a teacher, a police officer, spouse, a sibling, or more, Shawnee Wilson's going to bring some really, really good stuff, and that is over on WRUR. Our thanks to the entire team, Josephine Perini volunteering with us. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.